le PowerPoint, j'ai ici le retour. Je peux commencer de toute façon si vous arrivez.
So my contribution is in a sense a citizen contribution, in the sense that I started working on issues related to digital information because of personal reasons. That is, having babies who enter the school system, it was important for me to decide what to do at the individual level, so make decisions about a number of say gadgets that are going to populate our family. Is it working? Excellent. Two technicians are better than one. So, and I wanted to mention this because it's a way to clarify the precise role that I'm doing. So I'm a philosopher working in the Department of Cognitive Science. And so my problem was to make sure that the decision I am making and the decision my school board is making, the decision society at large is making on the issue of what is called the digital migration, are decisions which are informed by the best evidence we can get. Of course, I work as a scientist, so I'm trying to get the best evidence as I can. But also, I'm a philosopher, so I'm trying to make sure that the language we're using for describing the different elements of a digital migration is an appropriate language. So it's not a language that is going to confuse the decision, a language that is going to assist it. So I published this book a couple of years back, and I got a number of criticisms of the book. I would say a couple of things about that. So one is 10% of the blog entries on the book are of the type, I haven't read Roberto Casati's book yet, but I think he is wrong on this and this and this account, which is fine. I mean, I discussed also with people who didn't read the book. But one, at least, was very interesting. It was, I haven't read Casati's book yet, but I think already the title is completely wrong. How could you be against the digital? Which means, actually, you didn't read the title. The title is not against the digitalism. It's pas contre le numérique. It's against digital colonialism. I'm not against a format. I'm against an ideology. And the two things are important to be kept apart. And so my next book actually is an extension to this. Is a supplement, which is trying to make clear that we are talking precisely about the things we are talking about as much as we can, I mean, given the available evidence. And the hope is to be able to assist decision making at various levels. As I said, there's a personal level, the level of the family, of the school, of society at large, in an information landscape which is noisy, to say the least. At best, I think it's noisy. And I think I'm trying to challenge the gods of information. Okay, so this is an example of clouded landscape. A magazine is an iPad that does not work. 4 million hits on this YouTube thing, and it was presented to me by Bruno Mari, who is the CEO of Giunti, one of the largest publishing groups in Italy. Roberto, what are we going to do with our readers? This is what happens in this video, which is very popular. This one works, and this one doesn't work. So the thing that works is there is this small lady who's started toying with an iPad, and then she's given the opportunity of play with a paper magazine. And she's trying to do things with a paper magazine, like enlarging the picture. Okay, this is the type of thing that parents are supposed to cope with. Spritz. Does anybody know about Spritz? Spritz Inc., a new company. Reading Reimagined. They're planning to move 20% of reading practices to this type of interface. So the interface is flashing words at you. Can you read? Good enough. So this is about the speed at which we as fast readers. And of course, by using some of the interesting aspects of the visual system, okay. Good enough. You can read most of it. So this is it's a training issue. You can get better and better to it. And the point is an optimization, or let's call it an optimization of your reading abilities, because when you read, typically you move your eye from word to word, going to an important letter in the word, which can be detected and found for each word, which is a red letter in this case. And moving from word to word, you are wasting time and energy, basically, because saccades, which are moving, are ballistic movements. That is, you have to launch a muscle contraction and then break the ball, when the eyeball, when it has to stabilize on the red, the pivot letter. And these are very small costs. There are some analogies to what we heard before. There are small costs that could be optimized, because very small costs add up at the end of the day, and they make for very huge costs. So you can speed up your reading abilities 3 times, and that would be very interesting for people who work on Amazon Turing, because they can make even a larger profit.
They're probably trained for
doing this. And I would like to say this is a device which is based on the best research in cognitive science. My point is, as a parent and as a parent of children, school children, is whether I should have my children move toward this type of reading. The landscape is clouded. There are intellectuals writing very much trumpeted books on the magnificent prospects of just giving a tablet to a population of low-skilled people, and something really wonderful is going to happen because of serendipity. I don't know, I can add up, so this is the other elements of a clouded landscape, the living headstone. So there is a QR code which is carved in granite on your headstone when you die, and so that information about you can be gathered by people visiting your tomb at the cemetery, and things like that. So it's a complex landscape, and it's very complicated to make any reasonable decision unless you get a lot of information about what goes on, which is part of what I've been doing in the last years. As I said, the main point is that I'm not against the digital. I actually developed some software, minor things for education. I'm criticizing not a format, but an ideology, and this ideology is expressed in a conditional form. Whatever can go digital must go digital. That is finance, government, education, communication, entertainment. Wherever you have a possibility of having something that goes digital, then it must go digital. This is the ideology that I am contrasting. It's not easy to contrast this ideology for a number of reasons. One reason is that there is no whereas the ideology as a simple affirmative formulation, so wherever can go digital, it's very hard to find a simple negation of this thesis. You have to be able to enter into the details of each different activity. There are some activities for which going digital has been a boosting of the internal quality of the activity. With a kind of revelation in Maurizio's terms, I would say digital photography, for instance. Photography has been totally liberated by the digital, and also the practice of photography has changed. We do photography in a way we didn't do before. Photography has been liberated because it is now just note-taking and not a ceremonial activity. But There are also activities for which going digital is clearly detrimental. I would say voting, maybe we'll say something about that later on. And there is a gray area in the middle, a gray area for which there can only be a case-by-case decision. So my contribution when I talk to parents, to school teachers, is always to make sure that for each activity we face the problem as a design issue. There is a design issue for each activity, and maybe it is good to go digital, maybe it's good to go digital in a certain amount, maybe it is completely wrong to go digital. We have to assess it on a case-by-case basis. So this is more or less the content of the book. I'm not going to through all of this, but I'm going to talk mostly about the bottom line, and it is the same old brain. A large part of the book is devoted to books and reading, so it draws on the previous book, and teaching and learning. The intellectual landscape, as I said, is not only the media landscape, but also the intellectual landscape is very polarized, and the spectrum goes from digital Luddites to digital colonialists, with a number of intermediate steps you can find in the literature. So this is a way of charting the landscape: cypherpunks, hackers, digital negotiators. This is myself and Antonio Casilli, I guess. Passive digital subjects. Actually, there can be many of us can be in that state anyway. And then Panglossians, that is enthusiast followers of digital trends, evangelists, and colonialists, and a number of books. I have, I just go through some of them. Carr, reflecting more or less the spectrum that I just drafted. Schirmacher, Spitzer, an interesting book which is called Digitale Demenz, which is apparently is not going to be translated in English for a strong opposition of the corporation, which is very strange. Morozov, quoted, Eli Pariser, who described some of the phenomena of the filter bubble, so the fact that you get trapped into recommender systems, and others related to surveillance and privacy. Then you move into the enthusiast field, Prensky, who invented the word digital natives, and some of the followers in Italy and France, and people who believe that the humanities are going to be changed by data mining, which is also possible. and of course, people who are somehow conflict of interest related, like the former CEO of Google, who writes a book on the new digital age, and so on and so forth. So let me say something about the bottom line, which is, I guess, interesting for philosophers and non-philosophers. The arrow here means pay attention and make sure that sometime in the appropriate context you replace the concept to the left of the arrow to the concept with the concept to the right of the arrow. So it's not an implication arrow, it's a suggestion for replacement. There is a difference between digitizing X and digitizing a representation of X. This is important because, although it might seem completely trivial to most of you and to philosophers, this is part of the ideology of digital colonialism, that you can really digitize everything. And of course, what you can easily digitize is something which is already in an information friendly format. Representations, basically. So you can digitize a picture, you can digitize communication, you can digitize words. That is, you can put them in a format which is a 0-1 format and can be read by a machine, basically. And this is very easy for representation because they are already in a representational format, which can be easily, whose syntax can be easily, they have a syntax, and the syntax is what you need in order for producing this translation into a language, which is a language which can be read by a machine. There are things that you can simply cannot digitize. So food. Food cannot be digitized. When I say this, people typically say, of course food cannot be digitized, and others say, of course food can be digitized. You can take a picture of food and then you can digitize. Well, you can digitize the picture, but food cannot be digitized. You cannot eat digitized food. Food, sex, a number of other things cannot be digitized. what you can digitize are representations of those things. But you need to ingest atoms and molecules and not moving electrons in a syntactically suitable format. I say this because although it seems trivial, it's an element which comes up time and again in discussions, that you can really digitize everything, and people tend to use digitization here for as a proxy for modelization. You can make a model, and this model can be digital, but some things you cannot digitize. Another important distinction is the distinction between digitizing X and digitally assisting X. You cannot digitize sport. I mean, if you really want to change your aerobic levels, you have to run and jump physically. There is no digital substitute for sport. But you can digitally assist sport. For instance, you can buy a Wii and then play in front of a Wii, and then you jump and do things. But you didn't digitize your activity. You were digitally assisting your activity. Again, it seems to be trivial, but there is a long list of cases in which the distinction is neglected in order to promote the cause of the digital colonialism. For the element, here I allow myself to be relatively sloppy, as the literature is, there is a difference between digital and electronic. I mean, a book, a paper book, is a digital device. It is in digital format, not in analog format. It is not supported by an electronic hardware. So when we talk about the book versus digital, which is what I hear most of the time in discussions with school teachers, it's not a good distinction. I mean, the distinction is between electronic and non-electronic, and it is orthogonal to the distinction between digital and non-digital. As a corollary, we talk about Second Life or virtual reality. These are not realities in the sense in which reality is a reality. These are representations of reality which induce in us the belief that we are in front of something real. So these are representations of reality with a certain degree of realism or even photorealism, but these are not worlds, these are not realities. They're just representations. There is not such a thing as a virtual reality. Access to knowledge. This is something which has been repeated over and over again in all discussions about why we should, for instance, introduce many digital devices or electronic devices, if you prefer, in schools. There is no such a thing as access to knowledge. You can have access to information. Some of this information is going to be true, so you might have access to truth. But knowledge is something that you have to develop and build yourself. So you can have access to the statement of Pythagoras' theorem. Fine. So you can read the statement, but you do not know thereby Pythagoras' theorem. You know Pythagoras' theorem when you are able to solve a problem which has as a necessary part knowledge of Pythagorean theorem. You can access the formulation, you can access the information, but you cannot access any knowledge. If you find that this is controversial, because I can see faces that claim that this is controversial, I'm happy to discuss about any of those. So this was the first part, the basic distinction. Let me say something about is the same old brain. It is claimed that exposure to digital interfaces, in particular to screens, has changed our brains. In particular, it has changed the brains of the new generations, which are exposed to them from very early on. In a sense, this is trivial, because exposure to anything changes your brain. Your brain is a learning brain, so it's going to change anyway. The point which is made is a different point, is that the brain has been changed in such a sense in which by the simple fact that they've been exposed to screens and digital interface since very old age, a very young age, sorry. Some children, now teenagers, now adults, have developed a different set of skills and competences, particularly evident in manipulating voice interfaces. So the little lady that we saw in the YouTube video at the beginning is one of those digital natives who has certain competences in manipulating objects and has a different type of intelligence. The watermark of this type of intelligence is multitasking, the ability of doing many different things at the same time. Okay. We know that the brain does a lot of multitasking. Of course, I couldn't sit, look at you, talk to you, breathe, think of the next sentence, monitor what I said, a number of things, if my brain was not in a multitasking mode. But most of this multitasking is totally unconscious. And it has to be unconscious, because if I started thinking of the way to control my muscles on my back in order to keep upright, I would probably fall down. It's too complicated to do, and it has to be automatized. So unconscious multitasking is obvious, almost trivial in the architecture of the brain. Conscious multitasking is not. It simply does not exist. There is no way for you to learn, to start learning Le Corbeau et le Renard and fill in your tax form at the same time. And you might try if you want, and it's going to be very bad at the end of the day for both activities. So what happens? You can't do that at the same time. Simply, it is impossible. You don't have the attentional resources for doing this. What happens? Actually, you are switching from one task to the other as fast as you want, but it is switching. You are first trying to learn Le Corbeau et le Renard, and trying to fill in your tax form, and back to Corbeau et Renard, and back to tax form. This is the same that happens with saccadic movements for your eyes. Each movement, each change, is costly. It has a cost. And there is something which is very easy to measure in psychology. It is time. Time is the easiest to measure dependent variable. This cost is expressed in terms of time. It takes you time to move from one task to the other and back. Maybe not much time, but time still. So the more you switch, the more you believe you're multitasking, the more you're using up this precious resource, which is your time. At the end of the day, time sums up. So zillions of experiments have been done now on multitaskers for one reason, which is related to driving and to safety on driving. So they have been tested in many different types of tasks. If you do the two tasks, Corbeau Renard task declaration, serially, that is, first you try to learn Corbeau Renard and then you try to fill in your task declaration, at the end of the day, it takes you less time than trying to switch from one to the next and back. This is simple to measure. But this is the relatively trivial part of the story. You can make prediction about the new type of intelligence, which is the multitasking intelligence. One prediction is that, well, of course, practice makes perfect. We know it for all types of human practice. We know that practice makes perfect. You want to learn to play chords on a violin or scales on a piano, on trying somersault, on anything, or Corbeau Renard, whatever. Practice makes perfect. So why shouldn't we make the prediction that multitaskers develop better strategies for monitoring their attention and moving from one task to the next in such a way that, in the end, the cost of task switching, actually, not multitasking, are going to be reduced? So this was tested. It's an interesting work by Ophir in 2009, and then replicated. You take three populations: a population of heavy multitaskers, a population of mild multitaskers, and a population of no multitaskers. And then you administer them classical attentional tests. Attentional tests are tests in which you have a target to be found in a population of slightly dissimilar destructors. And you measure the time it takes to, in the test of a different population, to find the target in a population of destructors. Multitaskers, you should expect, are going to be better at performing this attention visual search task. And it actually turns out that this is not the case. Multitaskers are worse in the free populations in managing and trying to moderate or modulate their attention. Typically, what happens is actually the opposite than the prediction was suggesting. They are not training their attention. They are training their distraction. They are getting more and more capable of being easily distracted by whatever stimulus pops up in their visual field or auditory field or attentional field at large. So, not only multitasking should be replaced by task switching, once we get to the real thing, that is task switching, we can make the real measures, and the real measures militate against the idea that there are digital natives of any sort. Digital natives is the other metaphor that I worked on quite a lot. Natives is the term which is tricky here, because it is used in other contexts from the cognitive sciences to describe language natives. So people who, by simple exposure, develop a language. That is, each of us in a young age. Languages are not taught, they are not learned. They are simply developed after exposure to the appropriate stimuli. First languages, at least. Which is not the case for my English or for my French, actually. They come as second languages, and you can tell. But first languages are simply developed. And the idea is that digital natives would develop digital competences, undescribed digital competences, in the same sense in which Italian natives or English-speaking natives develop their first language. This is a selection of the first picture you could find in 2014 when you entered digital natives and were looking for images on Bing. So these are the digital native ideologies. I don't have any good replacement for digital natives. I suggest here digital subjects, that is, people who simply are passively exposed to digital technologies since young age. But I don't want to claim this is any better than a description. Any description that simply suggests that there is no such thing as digital nativity. There are many other instances on top of multitasking, which I describe, of cases in which there is no specific signs or mark of a digital intelligence. And this takes me to my main point, the take-home message of my lecture today. It is not that the human brain has changed because of technology in the sense of producing a population of natives by simple exposure. It's actually the opposite that has happened. Technology in the last 10 years, 15 years, has changed in order to be used by a brain which is a baby's brain. Let me repeat this. So it is not that by simply staying in front of a computer or a screen or interacting with a tactile tablet or whatever, you develop a particular competence which is similar to the competence a linguistic native develops when in front of a linguistic stimulus. So this is used typically as an explanation of why children, babies, toddlers, can play with an iPad. This is used as an explanation. The explanation is actually the other way around. The iPad, and I mention the iPad because it all started from this type of work, the iPad made a big change because it tackled the problem of new market niches in design terms. It didn't make a big software leap, a big hardware leap. it made a design leap. And the design leap was, let's make a technology that everyone can use without any training whatsoever. So 15 years ago, you bought a computer. You had to call a friend for installing software, connection to the internet. Let's not mention it. Things that don't work, repair person. The technology was visible. You had to interact with the technology. Even earlier than that, you had to code almost. I mean, you had online, you had inline commands in DOS. All this had to disappear. It had to disappear because it was a major barrier to the expansion of the computer market. And the expansion came from the fact that now the computer is something that you just open. You open a tablet, you unpack it, and you touch it, and something is going to happen. Sounds pop up and beautiful colors, and it, you don't have to do any particular training. It simply works. So the technology changed in order to adapt to an extremely low-skilled set of capabilities. This is the proof of what I'm saying. We are not talking about a population of digital natives which is bound in time and space. Everybody is a digital native according to this very simple definition of digital native, someone who can unpack a computer and start develop any competence. My mother, this is not my mother, but my mother received a tablet as a present 2 years ago. I don't know why, but we did it. And in 15 minutes, she was able to do some basic things about it. And with little instruction, she was able to Skype and send emails and things like that. And she always resisted technology, also for probably power reason in the family. It was my father's precinct, but there is no such a thing as a new mind. There is simply a computer which can be adapted to any type of mind. So let me be a little bit more specific, not much, but a little bit more specific. When we talk about the interaction of the human brain with computers, in a landscape which is the landscape of the digital design revolution. So the digital design revolution is the revolution of usability conditions for computer, not of improvements in software, on hardware, or costs, just the usability condition. We see more and more populations like the so-called digital native population, who spend a lot of time in these interfaces, thereby creating digital labor, thereby creating total mobilization in the sense of Maurizio and Antonio. And we are looking for categories for describing this particular type of commitment to technology. Turkle has her ideas, emotional values, which are transmitted by technology. And I think the two models that are most widely used tend to be on two extremes on a spectrum. So the digital natives model, which is the anthropological mutation, the change in the brain, on the one hand. And on the opposite side, there is a completely different model, which is an almost medical model, which is the model of addiction. So people get addicted to interfaces. So I said what I think of the digital natives model, the anthropological mutation. I would like to say two words on the addiction model, which is put forward by way by Manfred Spitzer in the Digitale Demenz book. The addiction model seems to work for a limited amount of the population. So maybe 10 to 15% in some countries on average. It can be more in South Korea. It can be less in countries which have less exposure to digital interfaces. But it doesn't cover most of the uses. Addiction is a clinical condition which has a number of clear signatures, and it can be detected in many cases, but it is not the norm. So what I think is the correct model is an evolutionary-based model, which we developed together with Elena Pasquinelli, who wrote an interesting book on screens. It's called Irresistibly Scare Me and Irresistible Screens. Let's call it the cheesecake model. So the cheesecake model is the following. And I think it is important because it gives us instruments for or metaphors for dealing with the digital migration in terms of dietary intuitions. Our brain developed in an environment which was very low in sugars, in fats, and in salt. And that means that we simply developed antennae or Darwinian buttons, the phrase is Sherry Turkle's, for sugar and for salt. We simply can't help. And this is why it's so hard to diet. It's extremely hard. And this is why it's very implausible to create diet projects which are not design projects. And this is why it's very hard, very easy to make wrong design choices when you plan to diet. So suppose you are the nutritionist in a school and you want to improve the dietary requirements of the school. You might try the following design. Give each student a cheesecake and a salad and tell the student, you have to eat the salad. It's good for you. You shouldn't eat the cheesecake. Of course, the student eats the cheesecake because of the Darwinian buttons, which are there since eons in his brain. And now you tell the student, well, look, you should have eaten the salad. Cheesecake was not good for you. So poor design and guilt are two elements which you find very often in the discussion about the digital diet, especially in schools now. Reading, which is the salad here, I mean, of course, the healthy salad, is confronted with activities which are, of course, more interesting. They involve socializing. They involve looking at the last compilation of scores by Maradona and a number of things which are incredibly attractive and are part of our, they really are tapping into our digital, into our Darwinian buttons. And it's hopeless. Of course, the child is going to choose the last video of a cat who's flushing or things like that, which are quite interesting, of course. So the cheesecake model should help here, decision-making. Cheesecake model says it's not an anthropological mutation, it's not a case of addiction, it's just a problem of poor design. You have to be aware of the things that attract your pupils' attention. And they're there because they're there by design in the machines which are being designed in order to attract the attention of the pupil, to keep them constantly mobilized, keep them constantly present on the object. Design elements are also important in the way these objects, which are supposed to occupy a large part of our lives, are described. So the tablet is the Swiss Army knife of education. Because with a tablet, you can do so many different things. You can write, you can take, you can shoot movies, view movies, record music, edit music, evaluate a student, a number of other things. So this is a real Swiss Army knife, which is sold for £1,000 with 87 implements. The problem with the metaphor is that nobody uses a Swiss Army knife in their kitchens. Who does? Any of you? So your kitchen is more like this or more like that? Hopefully it's more like that. For a reason, is that the Swiss Army knife does a lot of wonderful things, but it does each of them in a very poor way because of the design constraints. You want so many functions in a single object. For instance, it's very hard to perform two different functions with one single object, which is also a strong limitation. So considering school environments or education environments, which are my main target as targets, are places in which you have to introduce devices which have this feature of being multi-purpose or multifunction, is like trying to introduce a Swiss Army knife in your kitchen. Or vice versa, is considering schools or education settings as camping site situations in which you deprive yourself of an incredible number of wonderful tools which have been proved by history, there is a lot of evidence about them, and go for just technological innovation with no project whatsoever. So, take-home message is that we have to replace this "it just happens" approach, which is an approach which is very much liked by policymakers. Il faut vivre avec son temps. With a design approach, that is, what is the problem we want to solve? Is the digital migration useful in this, in assisting with this particular project? It's never just a technological problem, because this is a typical answer. There is a technological fix for all problems that you want to introduce. And my response to this is never just a technological problem. It's rather and almost always a design problem, that is a more complex problem with non-technological aspects we did not think of before, and for which we might not have answers, in particular, not technological answers. The example that I'm not going to make in full, but I'm just going to skim over, is the example of voting, the electronic voting systems. So there are many issues about an electronic voting system, which I'm not going to delve into, but the simple point is that in a pre-technological environment, voting is relatively simple. It has problems, manual voting, but it has an epistemological virtue. That is, everybody can understand what it is about. A population with any, the lowest possible skill, that is, you have to be able to make sums, understand something about representation, can understand any manual voting system. If you want to understand any electronic voting system, you need something of this competence. Comprehension of a very complex flow chart. And there is no technological fix for this. There is no technological fix. You have to raise the competence of the whole population so they could be able to hack a voting system and understand what goes on behind the screen. But I would say this is a simple case, and this is the example I want to make. Online voting, which is the next step after electronic voting, online voting has all the problems of electronic voting system and has a unsolvable design problem, which is, suppose we were all allowed to vote from, I don't have one, so I'm not geolocalizable with my wife, as I mentioned before, but from a smartphone. Suppose you can vote from your smartphone, which is trumpeted as the next frontier of democracy. Well, you should consider what's going to happen and what already happens with the correspondence, absentee ballots. Families are going to be polls, stations. And in families, everybody's carrying their poll station. Micro powers in families are going to be exerting their privileges. The father is going to tell the children what they should vote. The husband, the wife. Bosses are going to organize voting parties in the comfortable environments of their premises and asking employees to vote for the benefits of a company. And there is no way to solve this problem. I mean, if you put the voting privileges into a mobile device, voting becomes mobile. and there is no way to technologically fix this. There's been proposals, which I have laughable proposals for doing this. Like one of these is we should be able to make sure we can be certain about the result of our voting. So you get a sort of a receipt for your voting choice, which means, I mean, if you get paper receipts for your voting choices, there's going to be a trade of voting receipts, derivatives, futures, very quickly. So mobile voting is a mafia paradise or micropower paradise, and there is no technological solution to this, no technological fix. Low tech is the solution to voting problems, and we have to face it. I'm finishing on this. So I was mentioning before, accepting small decisions, small transactions like mutual geolocalization or the commodity of voting from home in some circumstances. We are all used to Doodle. Well, Doodle is an open and overt voting system, so it doesn't count. Produces a change in the defaults of the system. And the change in the default of a system is something we have to be careful about, also if we want to take action. Antonio was suggesting that we should get organized or take action. He was actually documenting and suggesting implicitly that we should get organized and take action. But we also have to understand not only the mechanism, but the nature of the mechanism, which is a design, a set of design choices, which we can influence in some cases. The move from transactional to ecological is one of the strongest moves I can see today in ACT, and we have to be very careful in accepting transactions, small commodities for big changes of default. And finally, the question we have to ask is whether innovation is progress. And I think the term innovation, I was Google charting on an engram the growth of innovation over the last century and the decline of progress in public discourse and in the database at large. We talk more and more about innovation, and innovation seems to be a word with automatic normativity, automatic positive normativity. Of course it is not. We can decide to eat with our feet. It's a big innovation. It's not a progress, I suppose. And we have to start think in normative terms. Normativity is the, if you want, the keyword of my project here. I'm proposing to replace certain meanings with other meanings. It's a huge normative progress. We have to face it. It's going to be normative through and through. Thank you for your attention.
So thank you very much. I agree with most of you were saying, but I think you are talking about more about a particular discourse of the hardware and software industry than of the digital tools or digital environments themselves. I mean, yes, what you say is true about iPad and about a lot of the discourse Apple sells to us, but it is not true if I take my Linux laptop and I give it to a little girl, I don't think she's able even to turn it on. So I think you are talking against an industrial discourse more than the digital tool and environments themselves.
I'm a friend of open software and of open hardware even. The point is, we are not living in a frictionless world in which Apple doesn't exist and only Linux exists. So the discourse, which is framed in decision-making at different decision-making levels, is totally framed by the design revolution and not by the software capability improvements, even software capability together with a possibility of control. If you look at what ministries of education are going to do for digital plans in the next years, is nothing to do with, very little to do with free software and hardware. It's about buying tablets. I received a letter by Hidalgo about the mayor of Paris, about the digital plan for Paris, and next year each pupil in college, so middle school, first year middle school, is going to have a tablet. Why? And is it going to be, which tablet is going to be? Nobody knows, but we can easily imagine, guess. So it's not a frictionless world.
I agree very much with your conclusions, in particular with the fact that we are faced by a great set of design problems and of sort kind of design that require social, political, as well environmental choices. But I have a little problem with a step in the reasoning of a presentation, is that I would rather not drop the anthropological mutation approach together with the version you have described, in the sense that I belong to, I mean, I'm in a conflict of interest there, because I belong to the school of discourse of anthropological mutation about IT and the digital world, but in a sense that does not require at all to imagine there is a brain mutation, in a sense, and so does Bernard Sigler, let's say. You can have a vision of anthropological mutation in the sense that the invention of writing was an anthropological mutation that, by the way, raised exactly the type of problems that you highlight, and the answer again was to work on design decisions. And so just more comment than a question, I mean, but I would like, because
by
you could, if you drop the intensity of a change, then you might fall in another trap, which is thinking, oh, this is just another technological revolution, like, you know, the steam engine and the electricity, and we are, and all we have to do is to adapt in the same manner we did with this invention, which is, I think, would be misleading.
I'm trying to assist individual decision. So this is my role as a philosopher, as an intellectual, and I spend a lot of time talking to people about this individual decision that we have to make. Each of us has to make this decision about what to migrate to the digital sphere, what to keep in a different world, and in which way. So my contribution is to provide, say, a vocabulary for describing the phenomena we are describing. So my only interest is I'm a pragmatic philosopher. So I want my, whatever I produce, I want to be useful. Yeah, so if a vocabulary is not useful, it's going to be a problem, because there are different communities using different ways. I'm happy to revise my vocabulary. So, and in this particular case, I'm very, I would like to be very careful about the use of anthropological mutation, the way I use it and the way you suggest we should use it. I know that it is used in that particular sense. Writing produce an anthropological mutation in that sense. It's a metaphor anyway. We both agree on that. That's clear. It's not there are no mutations in the sense of genetics, in that sense. My problem is that the use of anthropological mutation in the general discourse is not at all the very sophisticated and sensitive use that you are making by describing from the viewpoint of academia. We both can make from the viewpoint of academia a certain set of phenomena, is the digital native use, which is made for suggesting that we have to introduce a certain type of tools in schools because those brains have changed and so on and so forth. So it's a context decision. I'm militating against the term anthropological mutation outside the academia, although we can decide to agree. And then, for reading and writing, but reading, of course, is more important than writing, because you have to be able to read in order to be able to use writing. Reading is not a mutation, of course, but is clearly a brain modification of major import. It's probably the biggest brain modification which is culture-based. Because in learning to read, you have to take two modules of your brain, which are a shape recognition module and a sound production module, phonetics module, and make them work together in a way which was not suggested by evolution. Of course, it takes 2,000 hours of intensive, dedicated work. So it is not mere exposure, definitely. So there is a cultural and institutional work on reading, which is there, and which is important. We have to do for each new baby, basically. You can't skip it. And the magic, which is conveyed by words like anthropological mutation and digital natives, is that you can skip over that work. Just give the interface. Michel Serre, I mean, I pronounce I'm under the control of the movie, but there was a very unresponsible set of statements about what parents should do. And I think this is the type of thing that we should oppose as much as we can in public discourse.